Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about Brad James. Brad is a consultant and the organizer of the Micro Minery Club. I'm going to talk about the industry with him, see where he thinks it's all going, what he's up to, and much more. Stay tuned. Right, so like I said in the introduction, I'm talking today to Mr. Brad James. I already introduced him as a consultant, but he just informed me he is also a bridge builder, mostly flew under the radar up until now, now that he's on Swan's YouTube channel. He helped to build or launch 42 facilities across the country or the globe. I'll ask him now. And he's also the founder of the Micro Mining Club and has a lot more things going on. With that being said, Brad, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Jesse.
My pleasure. We are at block height 844620. Hash rate on the 14 day is 598 exahashes. And our hash price is a bit more healthy, depending on how you see things, at 5539. Giving folks a bit of a breather with the recent price increase and also difficulty adjustment downwards. Brad, how do you see things? Do you look at the hash price often? Or what do you care about in the mining world?
I zoom out all the time. I try not to look at price. I try not to look at hash price. In fact, the only time I do that is when we have an economics call, which is about once a month, to look at the long-term view and look at the trajectory of the history and where that potentially takes us over the course of the next quarter. Otherwise, it's so volatile that you will go nuts if you try and follow it.
Yeah. When do you have those calls where this is important?
Usually at the beginning of the month or the end of the month, it varies. We just try to do it once a month, every 3 to 4 weeks, where we'll dive in, we'll look at the fleets, we'll understand how they're doing. And for most of our clients, they're doing this regularly too. And we do an annual review with any large fleets or large clients.
Okay, maybe, we need to take a step back. Give people a bit of an intro, Brad, into yourself, as most of the people who listen to this content are probably not from the industry, and you've also flown under the radar, so you might be news to even some of the more well-known people in the space. Give people a bit of an intro and how you stumbled over Bitcoin.
For sure. I like most, got into Bitcoin, or not most, but a lot of people who do mining, they got into Bitcoin right around 2011, 2012, right as I was graduating college. Bought some Bitcoin, and as a young professional, was not smart enough to be financially responsible and ended up selling it to cover bills. And then got back into Bitcoin mining, specifically with a mentor of mine in 2016. And then in 2017 was asked to go and build an at-scale facility here in the US. So 2017, 2018 was building out our first sets of facilities. And keep in mind, back then, that's 1 to 5 megawatts really was an at-scale facility. And since then, have continued to work in the space, continued to manage operations. Started the Build a Mine virtual boot camp in 2021, where I knew I couldn't build them fast enough, but I knew I could teach it. So put together the framework, started figuring out what that looked like in the 6 phases of building and scaling a mine. And now we're here with a whole bunch of facilities, a whole bunch of hash rate, a bunch of clients we work with varying in size, and really just trying to build a strong ecosystem of private miners who are smaller, mid-size, not big publicly traded miners, but give them access to the types of resources and success that the big miners often tout.
So Build a Mine bootcamp, right? Why mm-hmm. would you choose to, sort of fly under the radar when you have something like that going on, where, you know, I would guess your business benefits from your name and your person being well-known and connected to the expertise you have?
I think honestly, it came from a capacity aspect, right? So with the Build a Mine virtual bootcamp, the whole point of it was to lay out some frameworks to really begin standardizing how these facilities could be built. And then on the back end, we would obtain so many clients that we knew if Brad, if I was the one who had the knowledge between my ears, that there's still only 24 hours in the day. So over the last few years, we've been figuring out how do we capture it? How do we pull it out and put it into a digestible format so I don't have to be in front of everybody all the time, all day long. That's why we flew under the radar. And you know, for the record, we've been still figuring out all this stuff. There has not been a single site that we've helped with that's been built exactly the same way. So even though we have frameworks, there's still a lot of intensive work that goes into planning, constructing, launching, optimizing, scaling, and customer acquisition for all of these sites. So every single site is kind of its own puzzle, if that makes sense.
If you had to name a few things that changed building a 1 to 5 megawatt site back then versus now, what comes to mind?
I would say the biggest thing that I learned along that aspect, because keep in mind, I'm not an expert electrician. I'm not an expert in climate control. I'm not an expert in computer science or network architecture or engineering or any of that. The couple big things. One, network architecture has changed just based on how these computers run and how much they're processing and how fast they're processing and trying to get signal out of the facility into the internet, to the pools and back. That's one thing. So I've learned a ton about network topology, how to structure it, ensuring that if you have older units that you're setting up the architecture so that the less hash rate units are able to actually get their data packets out of the facility rather than being drowned in a network storm is one big thing. So network architecture has been a big thing that I've had to like learn the hard way. The other thing I think I would say is all the climate control mechanisms. Our first facilities were all air-cooled. They were all built on 4 by 6 foot by 2 foot racks with covers over them, using single air handlers that you probably find in a furnace in your home and some custom filter boxes and piping with holes cut and things. Now we're dealing with not only airflow and containers, which weren't really a thing back then, and now we're dealing with immersion, hydro, big exhaust fans. You know, we putting in hundreds of big exhaust fans that are running tens of thousands of CFM. Like that's a whole different game in terms of managing heat and the climate of this equipment as well, let alone looking at cooling towers and water treatment and everything else. I think those are the two big things that for me, I've had to learn, because I'm always looking at a facility at a 10,000 foot view rather than looking at usually at the individual miner where we're trying to delegate that to a technician who's more technically astute at that level and can help pick that specific unit apart.
And where do you think it's like, if we have this conversation in 5 years, what do you think would have changed? Do you think we'll have as much air cooling, for instance, or will that have moved all to immersion?
Well, I think to take even a step back, right? The power accessibility has shifted. And I've called this for years. I said the at-scale facilities that we were building in 2017, 2018, 2019, that's where all of the new deployments are going to go. We're not going to see the 100, 200, 300 megawatt facility spring up from here on out, which means the whole climate control aspect of it is going to shift. And it's going to be very specific to the region. So I don't think you can make a blanket statement on what it's going to be, but I do think 5 years from now, what we are going to see is probably some of these facilities totally shift from being, one, they're not going to be big, they're going to be micromineries, hence the name Micromineery Club, which is why we've been working that route and trying to teach people about you're running a small business. They're all going to be smaller deployments, you know, anywhere from 3 or 5 megawatts up to max 15, 20. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is you're going to see some of these facilities that were built with PPAs that are not necessarily as profitable, probably shift and just restructure their infrastructure to serve either HPC or AI or some form of other revenue generating source that will bring in higher revenue rather than just the Bitcoin mining revenue that comes in from them. Those are two big predictions that I have. I don't know. Don't ask me to tie numbers to them, But I think those will be part of the dialogue that is going to be critical to how people then pivot.
Yeah, I think putting numbers on things in Bitcoin mining over the mid or long term is pretty pointless. But you can kind of guess yes. where, you know, where hash rate is moving, for instance. I'm sure you're seeing a lot of that as well, right? Whereas probably five mm-hmm. years ago, you were purely US focused, I would guess. That has now shifted oh, yeah. and you're looking at, you know, sites around the world.
Yes.
Just going back to network infrastructure, right? Because even I, who I would say has an above average Bitcoin interested knowledge on mining, I would just, you know, buy a few switches, put cables together, mm-hmm. Put them into my router, and off to the races we go. What do you think are some like really big pitfalls that people often fall into when it comes to stretching their networking? What do you need to look out for? Let's get into that a little bit more. I want to understand that.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because I think even before you're even thinking about networking, take a step back and go, why am I mining, right? If you're somebody who's new into mining, understand what the goal is that you're trying to accomplish and how mining as a vehicle helps you get to that goal, whether it's acquiring Bitcoin or whatever it is, and then at the scale that you're trying to do. So first understand that. And then based on the scale of your deployment, that's when it really, we're learning all these intricacies, right? So taking a step back to 2016, remember building this in a closet with some S7s, a GPU rig, S9s were coming out, mining on a laptop that was sitting in, like we were playing with everything and tinkering, right? We could just take a regular dumb switch, plug it into a router that was connected to the Wi-Fi router that expanded throughout the factory, and we could make that work. But that means there were less than 20 computers on that network at a time, right? And they weren't competing for hash rate or sending data packets out. We didn't need what I like to call the traffic cop going you first, then you, then you, then you, right? Because that's what a firewall essentially does and smart routers do. Then once we began to build at scale facilities, thinking about the length of cable runs, thinking about how that traffic all needs to be coordinated. And back then, you know, we were dealing with millihash, gigahash, terahash, all these different magnitudes of hash rate. And we were trying to understand, again, not understanding any of this stuff, why certain machines were getting their hash rate out at the rate that was spec'd, while others weren't getting out, and trying to figure out, okay, what's actually going on? And I think at that point, that was more about, great, we went from 20 to 30, you know, 20 units running on a network to, at the time, a megawatt would be like 700 to 750 S9s, depending, right? And whatever else you were mining with at the time. That's a very different magnitude in terms of quantity of equipment pinging the same network. And I think what we learned there is that every time you go up by a magnitude of 10, right? So if you add a zero to the back end of it, not only on the hash rate, but the quantity of units, you have to be very specific about the data packets that are being sent out. They're not large, right? This isn't Netflix. This isn't HBO Max that you're downloading on the internet. No, they're tiny packets, but there's millions of them trying to get out all at the same time. And so many people are unaware that most of the internet infrastructure in the world was built for consumption, not uploading information. And so even internally, most people configure networks in a way for consumption. So I'm going to go watch a YouTube video. Maybe I'll send out a couple emails, right? And the emails are very small because it's black and white text and maybe there's an attachment, but that YouTube video that you're downloading is hundreds of megabytes, right? Maybe even a gigabyte, right? And so structuring your network in a way where there's, if it's a two-lane highway, both lanes are exactly the same size. So you can have upload and download at the same time internally. And then placing smart switches along the way so that you can coordinate where you know there's going to be broadcast storms or density of traffic hitting all one node in your topology. If I had the whiteboard going, Jesse, I'd just draw you a picture. But I think I think just understanding that. And I learned this in probably build 4 or 5 when we had a network architect come in from we were working with Best Buy at the time. And this was a Cisco Meraki architect who came in. He's like, I don't know how you're making this work, but it's not supposed to work. And that was the first time I realized that I needed to really dive in and begin to understand the intricacies specifically on the network architecture side. Because he said, what you're doing isn't wrong, but you see how you've got all these cables going into this, and they're from, you got 700 machines coming through here, and you've basically got this tiny little router on the tail end trying to designate IP addresses and everything else. It can't coordinate the traffic well enough because it's not a traffic cop that can work fast enough. You need to put like a stop and go light signal here so that everything can move quickly. And when we began to boil it down and look at it from that standpoint, it then shifted the whole conversation as well. We're like, oh, that means we need to start looking at climate control, probably more the more density we get. Everything began to scale up, but it all started because within the data aspect of it, it's all measurable, right? So you can look at the network and go, we can understand the traffic, and it's measured in packet size, in packet quantity, in packet loss, in latency, everything else. And that began to be almost a telltale sign as to where we needed to look to next.
It's funny that you said that the network was built for consumption rather than production, right? Which is a good analogy mm-hmm. to how electricity grids work, and Bitcoin mining sort of feeds into both. I think what you said is very important, right? Everybody that starts Bitcoin mining doesn't come from super specific backgrounds. There's no specialized companies who all of a sudden start Bitcoin mining because they're very good at network infrastructure, right? They all make their money yep. with their core business. And then along we come. And now we all of a sudden need to become experts in network infrastructure, HVAC, power markets, you know, demand response, heat yes. reuse. And yes. what's I think also a big change from, you know, a couple of years ago to today is the let me just say it has become more professional, right? You all of a sudden you have experts yes. for all these different angles, all of these different aspects of your mine, and it just makes you that much more efficient. While of course there's still, you know, always that founder in the background, maybe that is at the 10,000 feet view that coordinates everything and tells the HVAC guy to calm down. It's not the most important thing in the world. There's also other aspects to this, right? So you basically said, hey, I'm going to put my expertise into a program, the Build a Mine Bootcamp, right? And then you're going to have all these experts along with you helping to educate mm-hmm. your customers or the students basically along the way. What kind of... Give me the rundown again. What kind of aspects are you covering? Is it HVAC, heat reuse, network infrastructure, and all of that? Or is there anything that's that you haven't mentioned?
Yeah, I would say, look at it this way. So we took and boiled down through all of these facilities we've helped to construct and build in a variety of ways. And we boiled it down to 6 phases, right? You've got planning design is the first phase. And that includes picking a site, going into what is it going to look like in the layout and the competencies that go into actually constructing it, understanding who the players that need to be included in that are, understanding then the pro forma and the budgeting around that, and the project management, right? That's essentially when you're going through the Build a Mine Bootcamp that we've put together, you're leaving after 5 days of time with me and 9 other experts, a whole business plan, right? You're understanding what do I need to do to vet a site and what's an ideal site to great, what is the mindset and how do I need to start this whole process from a goal perspective rather than just diving in with no sense of direction. And then in day 3, we're diving into the competencies. That's the electricity, that's the network, that's the computer science, that's the climate control, the different components that go into it, everything along those things and the engineering that all of those have to intersect at. And then in day 4, we begin to dive into the numbers around each of those things. And now keep in mind, each of these days, they layer, right? Great, I found a site. What is my goal with the site? what do I need to do to change the site? And what are the competencies I need to have in order to do that? Great. All of those things cost money. And then by day five, you're going, okay, I've done all this stuff. I got the pro forma. Now what's next? And how do I manage phase two, which is the construction phase? So the idea is that we believe, and we've done this a couple times, and we believe you can do this if you're doing the right planning. If you do all the planning, you identify the site, you get all the construction put together, you get it all figured out, and especially within the age of containers, right? You can identify a site, vet the site, do everything. From the moment you book that site, whether it's leasing or purchasing it, if you have all of the planning and all the supply chain and everything else figured out from there, which we talk about supply chain, we talk about tools, all of that stuff, you should be able to get a site up and running within 90 days. From the moment, as long as the planning is in place. So then the construction phase is 90 days. Then we go into launch phase, which is usually 30 to 60 days. And then phase four, five, and six are client acquisition if you're doing co-location, optimization, and getting ready to scale up. The Build of Mine covers phase one, the planning and design. You need a business model. You need a plan of action. You need to know what you have access to and what you don't have access to. And then we lay out frameworks for everything. And every day there's a new tool that they get. And there's a new expert who's an expert in each of those things. That's the goal.
All right. Where do you think most mistakes are made today? Where do you see most mistakes being made? And what is that hot plate that everybody has to touch that you cannot teach?
I don't think people do enough number crunching. I don't think people look enough at the planning and the predicting of, not even predicting, but guessing as to what the range of error can be. Just because in Bitcoin mining, you're dealing with so many variables, right? You're dealing with Bitcoin price. You're dealing with hash rate increase. You're dealing with difficulty increase. You're dealing with power pricing, right? A lot of these facilities that are going up, are you doing real-time pricing? Are you buying blocks? Are you doing it a day before? Are you doing it after? Like, I think they need to run numbers more because, let's be honest, that's what all the big guys are doing. That's all they're doing. They've got somebody who's great with spreadsheets and great with finance and accounting and planning, and they're just running all the different variables of it, right? What happens if? One thing that people know me for is I say, in this industry, I have one quote. It's not about if things go wrong, it's when. So you need to at least put in some effort around planning for each of those contingencies. If you need to curtail the power, how are you dealing with that? How are you communicating that with clients? If Bitcoin price drops out the bottom, what is your runway that you can run your equipment and what is the length of time that you can run it at? If difficulty spikes, what are you doing to manage your fleet either through churn, dropping into low power mode, updating the firmware, managing it? Maybe you're only turning it on during off peak, right? All of these things are just levers that you can control, but you can't control all of them at once, right? And that's where I think if people put in the time to do the numbers crunching, which is why I think the mining economics is so important, whether you're an owner operator of a facility, whether you're managing a fleet of your own at that facility, or if you're a small retail miner who's got 1 to 10 units, right? I think everybody can put a little more time into the math. And if you do that, then you at least know what's going to happen when the variable you are most concerned about actually happens, right? You put $3,000 into a piece of equipment or $4,000 into a piece of equipment. You send it off to somebody who you don't know because your better half at home says, we're not running this loud thing in my house. And you can trust that there's going to be something that goes wrong, period. Right? Yeah. That's the one thing that you can predict.
True. Yeah.
So just plan for it. That's all.
Yeah, this thing back here, now that we're entering the winter, the colder days here in South Africa, that thing is going to churn a lot more again. But it does not run outside of this office much, I will admit that.
No.
All right, so let's say, hypothetically, and you tell me...
Is that an S9 back there?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that an S9 back there?
Yes. Yeah. The PDU is under the desk here. ready for drying wet children's clothing when they come back from outside. Anyway, I'll lay out a plan for you, Brad, and you tell me why that's not a good plan. Okay. I said to you, hey, I get three friends together. We put €2 million or $2 million in a pot. And from the first million, we get a contractor to get us a greenfield site with power access. And we're going to ask them to build it out, get us all the licensing and stuff as well. And then we'll end up with around 5 megs of power, right? And rec space. Okay. With the other million, we'll go and buy ASICs. And the other half of the 5 meg will probably host out. Is this a good plan or is this a bad plan and why?
So let me reiterate. That's why I was taking notes. Three friends, 2 million. You want to go find a greenfield. You're designating 1 million of that towards the infrastructure build out, right? And any contracts, permitting, anything else. 5 megawatts of power. And then you're taking the other 1 million in ASICs, which will probably be, you know, depending on the math, right? There's a lot more details that are missing from this, right? You've got high level pieces, but there's always questions at each one of those levels, right? Three friends, how close are you with the friends, right? There's a business model question there. Do you want to go in with three? Who's owning it? Who's making decisions? All of those things. You've got $2 million. You're estimating $1 million goes into the build out, permitting, everything else. What else goes into the miscellaneous costs when things get delayed, right? Supply chain, everything else. What does that cost you? What is the range plus or minus on that? And these are just a couple things. 5 megawatts of power. What's the source of the power and who's in control of it, right?
Right. Yeah, I should have said this would be probably from a contractor in Texas to get us access to ERCOT rates.
Okay.
Because I still think, this would also be a question for you. Let me write that down before I forget. Where do you see the best risk reward structure currently with the people that you're speaking to worldwide? Because I still think that's Texas. But then I don't understand why not everybody is going. Because there's so much space and so low power and such freedom to do business there that I think there is virtually no other better place to do it at. But sorry, we're diverting. Let's stick with my example.
I think you know, those are good building blocks. There's a bunch of questions at each level, right? Like, and I'm just asking the top ones off the top of my head. You know, you're Texas. Who's handling the power, the PPA down in Texas? Who's your QSE? Who's handling that? All of that good stuff. And part of the reason to answer your question, why people aren't flooding Texas, part of it is they struggle with planning the design or investing enough in the capital to deal with the climate control, depending on where it's located, right? Mm. With the massive amounts of heat, the further south you go, it's humid, it's heavy, it's all of that good stuff. Or let's say you're going to a greenfield that's being powered by wind, right? Like, what happens with all the wind power or solar? Like, there's so many questions about the sourcing of that power and how that's all working. Or, hey, if you're going to just be on the grid and just go with ERCOT, then what's the strategy around mining? Like, what's the gold price you're trying to work at? Are you going to be running 24 hours a day? You're going to be curtailing? That's where all of the power stuff, there's probably 100 different questions I have there. And I'm being round numbers. I don't know if it's exactly 100. But
we could probably get also to 100 then, pretty easily.
Oh, yeah, pretty easily. But then not only that, great. Then depending on the deployment, what type of equipment are you deploying? You know, certain pieces of mining gear are really, really finicky. And even within that, you might get certain pieces of equipment that based on the batch is really finicky. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to call anybody out on this.
I have
before. We all know if you've been in mining.
I have before. I'm just going to say at this point, why everybody in Africa is a micro BT maxi for a reason. But we'll leave it there.
Yeah. I guess the other part of it also is, if this is the route you're going, what is the goal for you and the three friends? Like, what are the three of you trying to get out of it?
Yeah.
That's like the big thing that I think everybody has to go back to first, because that's going to dictate whether or not you want to do it there. Because are any of your friends in Texas? Okay. So like some of the people we work with, it's very important to them that their sites are in close proximity to where they are located, right? Whether they're co-locating or they're running and building the site. These are all just details that you have to design your site to work for you, okay? When our first sites, when we finally got them optimized, I could literally say, and I could tout it, that I could run them from my phone because of the way we structured not only the engineering and how it worked and the tools we implemented in there, right? Cisco Meraki, its cloud-managed switches, how we built the climate control, it made sense, how we handled the temperature probes and everything else, how we handled ticketing and troubleshooting. And then I hired remote staff to help manage it, picking the right management tool that they liked and picked up, right? There's a lot of things that we chose, not only just on the technical mining side, but the business operational side, that's going to be very important because I didn't want to have to be there every single day, 8 to 12 hours a day. And when you're talking sites that are 1 to 2 megawatts, 1 to 3 megawatts, that's in this day and age, that's 1,000 new generation units. You probably only need one person, right? For, we say 1.5 people per 1,000 units. That's a realistic number that people should strive for and base their employment efforts off of. And that 1.5 people, they may not be techs, right? Like, I want to be very clear. That's 1.5 people that could be helping support the business or the admin or the client success or communication, but 1.5 people. Because you have to look at this, you're running property management, right? That's all you're doing. And your property management is, you've got a bunch of apartments, and instead of tenants, you've got computers, right? And if you keep this in mind, that's essentially the business model, it simplifies it so much. Now, people will argue with me, well, it's not that, it's big. I understand that. But if you're looking purely at the operational aspects of these facilities, that's all it is. You go rent it, you go buy a 150-unit apartment building, you're going to have a property manager that's managing business, projects, collecting rent, everything else. You're going to have a maintenance guy who's handling things. You're going to have outside contractors handling the elevators. You're going to have all of the same structure of team for the most part. And that's how the operation runs.
I guess
cool thing is with Bitcoin, you make more because it appreciates.
What you're saying is your infrastructure is your flat building and your miners are your tenants and you want to keep them happy with the infrastructure you're providing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
Exactly.
Do you talk to folks?
I don't know. Did I answer your question about your business model?
Yeah. No, I think you did. I think, look, the reason why I asked that is to highlight the work that you're doing. Right, because I kind of understand where the value add is. We're running a Gamma seed program together with Gridless and the Gamma folks, the other miners that are part of Gamma, awesome. Green Africa Mining Alliance. And the tagline there is, we want to enable folks to make mistakes more cheaply, and that's exactly what you're doing. Yes. Right, there's so much that you will only be able to look out for once you've done it, right? And so, like what you said earlier, you know, nobody without your guidance would think, hey, you know, I'm a father of 3 kids. I don't want to spend 50 hours in a container anymore. I'd like to run this thing from a phone, right, and then have a trusted service provider to execute whatever needs to be executed, right? And so those considerations are super important. But what's probably most important of all is why mine? Right? Do you cover that as well?
Yeah.
I mean, folks come to you with the decision to, hey, no, I want to start a Bitcoin mine. But do you ask them to take a step back and ask them why? Why do they want to do it?
I mean, and that's a big question. That's one of the reasons why we're putting on Miner Mastery in collaboration with the Bitcoin conference, right? Most people need to understand that potentially mining is not the best vehicle for them. I will always be the person who will ask you enough questions to go, is this the best vehicle for you to get to that goal, right? I think in the long term, when you're looking at mining and how it helps you acquire Bitcoin, the basic premise is, I know in the long run, it is going to be cheaper for me to pay for energy and use a tool to convert it into Bitcoin that will appreciate in the long term, that will actually give me a lower cost of Bitcoin than if I were to go buy spot ETF or spot Bitcoin or whatever I'm doing there, right? Like, that is the basic premise. Now, we've had these conversations with a lot of our clients who have continued to mine with us or through our network and through our ecosystem, where I finally ask, hey, you said you wanted to acquire X amount of Bitcoin at the beginning of our relationship, right? And they go, yup. And I ask, are you done mining Bitcoin then? And they say, no. And then the follow-on question has to be, why not? Right? And it's not, I'm a very much an abundance mentality person, right? Where I'm trying to look at, you're acquiring Bitcoin through this vehicle, and this vehicle takes some intensive upfront cash flow, and then a continuous subsidization of operating that business, because it's a business, right? A business is an investment, but a business is a very different type of investment. Whether you have one miner, whether you have 1,000 miners, right? Or 10,000, it's a business operation. So if you are not armed with the skill set to run a business, then the question of why do you want to mine Bitcoin? Well, I want to mine Bitcoin to acquire Bitcoin based on that basic premise I just laid out. Great. Do you have the skill sets to do it and navigate it? Taxes, finance, whatever those things are, which is why in day two of the Build a Mine Bootcamp, we actually go through an inventory, a resource inventory, a skill set inventory, a network inventory, as in like, who do you know? And we drive people to understand those things. In the Build a Mine aspect, they're building facilities. At Miner Mastery, we're diving in even to the basics, right? People who get into mining go, they've probably bought some sats somewhere, right? And then they heard about this mining thing and they have an intrigue and this relationship with technology that they want to learn more about it, right? It's more about the curiosity of it rather than the making money around it, because it's just interesting, especially early on. Now it's shifting and people are looking at mining as a tool or a vehicle to, yes, acquire Bitcoin, but also as an investment format to help level out potentially some of what they're making in their income, right? To mitigate taxes, to deploy another revenue source, to deploy another asset, because it is an asset that they can qualify on the books, whole variety of things. And so now the conversations have gotten a little more complex, because the complexity around those conversations are based on not just the acquisition of Bitcoin, but the mitigation of maybe some of these other risks that are out there in the world right now, financially or otherwise.
Yeah, it's, I think to this date, right? People who stumble over Bitcoin, like you and I, either were, I don't know, very lucky, or they just had a base level of curiosity, which made them stick with it. And it's not typically right from the beginning that you deal with mining. But the same type of personality that got you into Bitcoin will also wonder why you're not into Bitcoin mining, because it's just a very curious field that not many people understand. And then the same type of personality will sit down again and try to learn about it. And what you are trying to basically achieve with folks, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, is, right, when you say, hey, we can mine Bitcoin for lower than spot price, right? Otherwise, nobody would be doing it. There's risk with that, mm-hmm. right? There's no free lunch. And so the game is to keep that risk as low as possible and to keep your risks aligned, right? So when people tell me, oh, no, why don't I just go host in Ethiopia for 5 cents? It's because, and I tell my clients this, because I'm not bound by any operator. It's because you don't understand what the risk palette looks like. And I've talked to these guys and I know what the risks are. And trust me, with your first ASICs, that's probably not going to be the best place to go, nor is Paraguay, nor is correct. Paying 6.5 cents or 6 cents in South America worth it when you can pay a cent more in the US and have a controlled environment with the track record, right? Your assets need to be clean. They need to be kept well so that you can resell them when the market price goes up, because as you said, it's an asset. So it's about so many factors. And often I feel like shiny marketing tools will get people very greedy and lead them to making a lot of mistakes. And that's where I try to make my money, similar to you, right? By making folks understand this and educating them, making them happy customers, mm-hmm. and then come back to me, right? That's at the end of the day, the goal. Where would you start today, Brad? If you had your knowledge, what would your sort of just headlines, right? Where would you go? What size would you do? What cooling technique would you use? What do you think? What do you dream?
I've been touting this whole micro minery concept for a long time.
Yeah.
And there's been a few other people who've been kind of on the same wavelength for a long time. I think if we look at micromineries, and micromineries, guys, just to be clear on this idea, anything that's like half a megawatt up to 10 megawatts or 15 megawatts, that to me is a micromineery in this day and age. Okay. I'm from Wisconsin. So those of you who are unaware of Wisconsin, big beer state. So we brew a lot of beer. You've got big breweries and you've got microbreweries. So that was the concept. And the reason behind the micromineery effect of what we are looking at is that every single micromineery can offer specific features or value to a specific piece of equipment, a specific brand of equipment, a specific expertise, a specific value add, any of these things, right? So just like in beer, there are IPAs, lagers, pilsners, stouts, porters, all of these things, and everybody has their own preference. To me, that is where this is headed, not just in the size of these facilities, but in how people are interacting with them, right? And I think that it's going to have to be that way if people want to maintain decentralization. And we're dealing with pools, right? Pools and templates of the blocks and how those are how that's working versus the equipment that's being deployed. Man, back when I got started, there was probably 100 units, and realistically, you were going to see anywhere from 5 to 10 of them max, right? Now there's got to be north of 1,200 different types of units that are out there in the market. And I'm not just talking about the iterations of S19, J, K, 0, whatever. I'm talking about you've got new people coming onto the scene. You've got new people in manufacturing. You've got, you know, the little miners, right? The bit axes and all that. Like, there are so many different types of equipment now that no one facility will be able to fulfill demand that is needed for that variety of equipment, just of that alone. And so I think that's where it's going, both from a power accessibility standpoint, but a feature standpoint, right? And certain people are also going to begin to restructure these. The power agreements are going to be different. Hey, we're only mining at night here. Well, what does that mean? That means you're going to be on for 8 to 10 hours a day, and you're going to be off the other 14 to 16 hours a day, because we're only going to mine off peak, or 12 and 12, whatever that is. I think you're going to begin to see more of that. And you're going to see more of these micromineries pop up outside of the US, right? With all of the existing mining gear that's available. I for the last 2 years have been telling people, hang on to your S9s, because somebody's going to want to call you up and go, do you still have some of these? And in what condition are they? And you may say they're worth nothing. Yeah, to you, they may be worth nothing. To the guys who are doing the heaters, right? They may want to buy them used. To the people who are trying to outsource equipment, send it to places overseas like Africa or South America or wherever, they may be willing to pay a little bit of a premium if it's in working condition, right? And they know the history behind it. So I really believe that that's where I would start no matter what right now. I would go, look, I need to pick a niche and I need to stick with it. And then I need to market to that group of people, right? And I need to go, look, I have a site. It's specific to you. And here's why it's specific. And I'm going to make sure you're successful. And here's how, right? And I don't think it matters what it is, but specificity and attaching oneself to a specific micro minery concept is going to be really important, right? I'm going to educate everybody who's brand new into mining, okay? I'm only going to work with the big companies, okay? I'm only going to work with this type of unit. It doesn't matter what it is. I think people just will need to begin to pick, right? I'm only going to build sites for T21s.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the next hurdle.
Or
right?
I'm just going to focus on remodeling them to single phase.
Right.
I think what you're saying is spot on. I think it's where it has to go. I think it's a natural order of things as the network grows and becomes more competitive, right? Everybody seeks out profitability. And at the end of the day, you'll find mm-hmm. that in the niche. You'll find that in the DRC, in the jungle, and not in Wisconsin, probably, or wherever, right? Or you have to, what I love, the trifecta, Finland, you know, heat reuse, demand response, and cheap power as an mm-hmm. input. I think I'm very bullish on Finland, for instance, just because in the mid to long term, every miner will have to produce extra value somehow. Yesterday, I spoke to these guys who have seemingly come up with a way to convert heat into electricity at a 25%, 30% rate just by placing a container.
That's cool.
That's phenomenal. And they can store
awesome.
They can store the heat. And their idea then was to during off-peak times not take power from the grid, but you know, take all the excess heat that they have produced, store that somehow, and then produce electricity. Whether that works in practice or not, right? But that's where it's going,
right.
And that's where innovation is pushed.
We didn't even get into that. I mean, there's a couple of sites that we work with that are. Mining is a part of it. Mm. The focus is agriculture.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's so many different ways that we can look at this. The heat reuse. We had somebody come to one of our sites once and they were looking at vibrational energy and how to capture that. So all of the rotational energy or the vibrations on the shelving or the fans, right? How do you turn that into excess energy? And I was like, these are all really cool problems that are super interesting.
Yeah.
But I'm not smart enough to figure that stuff out. So
plus,
I just
Brad, the thing
through
is,
it.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but there is not enough pressure right now in the network to figure those things out.
Right?
But let hash rate go to 3 zeta hashes or 5 or whatever, and all of a sudden you are not profitable if you're not paid more than the next guy. And that vibration on the rack is money. You know what I mean? And this is what I mean by driving profitability. I mean, there's just today, right? I as I said, I had this presentation in the German Bundestag last week, and I talked to them about an 8 megawatt greenhouse in the north of Sweden, powered by GDA. I think that's growing tomatoes in the north of Sweden, in the middle of winter. You know, unheard of agricultural production. You no longer need to import those goods from overseas. Like, it just changes so many things. We could talk for ages. I want to know a couple more things before I let you go, Dred. Are you a fan of modeling more complex, or are you keeping it simple?
Yeah, I'm very much about keeping it simple. And in fact, we teach the KISS rule. Anytime you're building a facility and you're trying to figure out how the heck to tie all of these complexities together, you're gonna run into issues no matter what. So every time you add a complexity to it, you're adding another failure point in your operation or just in the business, right? So what we always talk about is in phases 1, 2, and 3, which is planning and design, construction, and launch, keep it simple. And then during your launch at the tail end, now you're putting in measurement tools so that in phase 5, which is optimization, now you can begin to look at those measurements and make incremental improvements, which then add layers of complexity because you've already built the base, right? That's the only way this works, especially in a place where there aren't enough people who understand how all of these pieces intermix. And that's the only way
Understood.
To make it work.
We talked earlier about specialization and, you know, seeking out productivity, keeping CapEx low and all of that stuff. There's a bunch of used machines, some of which I'm trying to sell. Where do you see those going? all these M30s that are flying around as 19J Pros that are not profitable in the US. Keeping in mind, right, not to make it too easy for you, that to ship these ASICs to places where there may be low power or low power prices, you need to now pay for shipping and duties again, which adds to the power cost. But if you have those machines today, you're not going to let a $4 per terahash market price go for 260. How do you navigate those complexities?
One, you try to find cheap power wherever they're located in whatever jurisdiction, right? And I think there are ways to do that. It might be in some sort of profit share. It could be finding a site that is somehow generating power off grid or leveraging some blend of power that makes sense. The other thing is to sit on them for a little bit, right? Find a way to just keep them where they're at and understand that, yeah, they're sitting on a pallet. So essentially they're a boat anchor, but that boat anchor at some point in time could become extremely valuable, right? We saw it with the S9s, if you remember, in the last bull run, all the S9s got shut off. Everybody remembers the picture of the truck with stacked to the top with S9s driving down the road. And then when the bull run happened in the last one happened, everybody's like, I wish I had that truck right now. I mean, those are the things that I think, that's why I always tell people, zoom out, right? Take a deep breath, zoom out. Mining is not a business in which you're going to generate profit every single day of the lifetime of that machine. It just doesn't work that way. But you also layer on top of that some sort of treasury management schedule, and you can now manage an operation and the fleet very profitably if you're taking into account the when things go wrong, as we discussed earlier, right? When the one metric that you didn't account for falls out the bottom, and now your business is not in the black, it's now in the red, how are you going to handle it? Do you have another lever to pull, right? A lot of those S19J Pros or S19s, hey, what does it do if you drop them into low power mode? What does that do? You know, maybe it works for you, maybe it doesn't. That's like one lever. What does it do if you find a solution where somebody's like, hey, we have excess power, we're willing to do some sort of profit share as long as you cover the cost of power out of the proceeds or the revenue. Okay. You know, and maybe that's a way to get something out of an old machine, because they're machines. And it's one of those things where you have to be creative about it. And at the end of the day, those creative solutions come purely out of the relationships that you've built. They don't come out of the equipment. It doesn't come out of the math. It doesn't come out of any of that stuff. It comes out of the fact of, have I been a good partner in whatever relationship I'm dealing with? And if you've been a good partner who has done their best, nobody's going to be perfect, but who has done their best to be transparent, to be held accountable, to come forward when you've screwed up, when you do those things, if you are a good person and you're making sure that you're doing what you can to remedy things and make it a worthwhile relationship for everybody, the cool thing about most Bitcoiners is that they're human too. Right? AI, I don't think, has taken over yet. They're human. And I think most people are trying to look at it from the standpoint of, we're all in this together. And if there's a way that we can make it a win-win for everybody, most people are willing to do it.
I almost want to finish on those good words, Brad. But I have to ask you what you do with the Micro Minery Club still. And please also briefly explain the Miner Mastery stuff that you put on at the events.
For sure. And thank you for the question. I can boil it down into both, okay? The idea of what I've been trying to do is build an ecosystem of high quality, high character individuals who are professionals in this industry. It's really, really hard in an industry that was grown out of people doing most of the development and mining out of their basement, right? It's really hard. I think we've accomplished that, where every single week on Thursday, a group of miners and mining professionals and supporters and service providers get together. I bring in a speaker most of the time, and we discuss and we learn from that professional and that speaker's best practices, right? Anywhere from finance and business operations, automation, anything on the business ops side, down to technical repair of the machines, to automation, to tools, to infrastructure, to electricity. basically so every single person in that room and anybody who watches the replay can level up, right? Either for themselves or for their organization. So we've got owners and operators, we've got techs, we've got, you name it, they're part of it, right? The other thing to keep in mind with that is that there's this network concept, okay? I have been really, really good at putting people together in positions where they now have a complementary solution or a complementary personality that will help each other out. Hence the minor mastery events, right? We can do a bunch of this digitally, but the culmination of it is, hey, can I get all of these people into a single room at least once a year to meet face to face? And so with that, what we're doing down in collaboration with Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville is kicking off the week with a Tuesday night reception and some opening remarks at Nissan Stadium, home of Nashville's professional football team. And then tying it into Wednesday, where we have two tracks, people who are brand new into mining and want to have success, and people who are masters in mining, which will culminate into probably close to an aggregate, just in the 40 some odd facilities we've helped with, close to 300 megawatts by the end of this year around the world, right? And these are all individuals trying to figure out, how do we level up? And so we bring in a group of qualified speakers who are not going to lead them astray. All of these speakers are vetted by me. We've done business with most of them. And the idea is that if I can eliminate the human risk by at least making sure everybody you interact with is of high character, that's what matters to me. And high character doesn't mean they're not going to make mistakes. High character means that when they make a mistake, they own it and they do their best to remedy it. And because I don't think anybody's been perfect in this industry. In fact, far from it, because we're all still figuring it out. And I know that everybody who I put in front of people, they will stand up and be the first person to go, yep, I screwed up. That's on me. Here's what I'm going to do to try and fix it. And I think that is one of the biggest risks that the industry and Bitcoin and everything in this new era of finance is dealing with, is how do you get in front of the best people, not trying to have to dodge, bob and weave from bad actor to bad actor to bad actor. Yeah. But just put me in front of the right people the first time. That's
and it. Also people who will respond positively if you have an educated critical question about what they're doing. That's always the biggest red flag for me. If you are if you're met with aggression when you're asking candid questions or educated questions in a very transparent industry, right? That's always a bit of a red flag.
That's why we're taking people to a tour on that Thursday, right, of one of the sites down in that area, because they need to see that it's not perfect, right? Like, you need to understand, if you're new in this industry, this isn't Amazon, right? Like, we're not running Google data centers with these mining facilities. And yet I think most people who are new in the industry, that's their expectation, right? Their expectation is that this thing is clean, pristine, server racks. No, guys, there's a reason we can put this stuff out, to your point, in Texas, out in the middle of a field where there's going to be dust and particulate flowing through it, and somehow this stuff is working for you while you sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the magic of this entire industry, is that we're finding ways to leverage resources that nobody was willing to leverage before.
It's funny that you say that. I have a client who buys machines, and they run a professional data center business, right? And that's what they expect. And then I send them a site video, and they're like, hold on, but this is not clean, climate controlled, rack service. You know, this is cables on the floor, loud machines on metal shelving with a hot and a cold aisle, you know? And it's like, yeah, but this is what these things look like. And this is actually a really good one, right? You should have seen others, others around, right? So I can definitely echo what you're saying. Brad, is there anything that I have not asked you that you wish I had?
I have a question for you, if that's okay.
Right. Go ahead.
What do you see that the industry needs that somebody hasn't stepped up to try and create?
Oh, man, that's a rough question. Good one. I think the industry needs an overview and more in-depth research on mining around the world and what the perceived risk is versus the actual risk. So I can only, you know, say from the standpoint of bringing more hash rate to Africa, right? This is why I started my company, bringing more hash rate to the continent. And just like with tourism, right? There's a lot of perceived risk. There's a lot of things that people tend to believe are true when they're not. And I think it keeps a lot of people from moving into certain areas that are more interesting. I want to see, and Ethiopia is a big deal right now, right? But if I wanted to start mining, and I really want to, I have to sort of see where the industry is going next. And as I alluded to earlier, I think it's going to go towards more productivity, more niche, cockroach of energy systems, mm-hmm. right? Gobble up every kilowatt hour that cannot be used elsewhere. And I think a lot of that can be found in Africa as electricity grids on this continent, as it grows, will not be centralized, right? To the point earlier, we'll not have consumption-oriented centralized grids. It'll all be mini grids, medium tension, mm-hmm. low tension grids, and they will all need Bitcoin mining. There's a funny story that Eric from Gridless told me, where one of their sites to balance the grid was using a 50 kilowatt heating element in the forebay of the hydro dam, just to balance the grid out, and they used it to heat up the water, right? And instead, now we have Bitcoin mining at site doing the same job while providing revenue. And I think you have to see where it goes next, right? Is it going to be Angola, Uganda, any of those countries that where people or investors would be like, hell no, I'll stay in Texas, right? And I think that's what we need more of. That's what people need to create, is means for the industry to gauge those risks more accurately.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the risk management side. That's really interesting. I think it's something that, you know, when we deploy to facilities not based in the US, we get a lot of questions, and often I connect them with a broker where I say, hey, make sure to discuss political risk, right? Because you can get political risk insurance, for example.
For sure.
And the challenge always with that risk mitigation side of the industry is the way the current insurance industry is set up, they don't want to move as fast as this industry wants to move. And so the data density is not there for them to make high quality discussions or judgments, which is why insurance itself is so costly for most of the people in this industry. Maybe not the big guys, but definitely everybody smaller than them.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, there is. It's funny that you say that, because the last interview I did was with somebody in insurance. Now, it got barely any views because of the title, right? But it is a very important.
It's important,
and it's super interesting. Like, I had so many questions for this guy, just like I have way more questions for you. So you'll have to come back. Last question I have for you, Brad. Always close the show out this way. Do you think that Bitcoin uses enough electricity or not?
Ooh, never. I think, and this is why I think Bitcoin has shown, and we talked about it, has shown to go to the fringes of where electricity is failing to be used and just being wasted. And there's purely shout out to a couple different people in the industry, but I've learned a lot about the more energy we use as a civilization, the more prosperous people are, right? So if you look at it from that standpoint, and I'm drawing a blank on the individual's name, and I wish I could give him credit right now, I apologize. But I think that his thesis of that really made me dive into it and go, okay, if we actually use more energy as a civilization and as a society, rather than trying to stymie the energy being used and instead look at, great, the more energy we use, which means more people will go into innovation of creative energy sources, just because of a profitability standpoint, we will actually surpass where we are at in terms of prosperity right now as a species. So I think the more we continue to push, and we're seeing this now even happen more with the advance of AI, right? And so we're gonna begin to see this happen. And maybe 5 to 10 years, we're not even talking about this, right? Maybe at that point, we're looking at energy is so cheap or almost free that, and that's an aggressive statement, but we're at a point where energy discussion about, we're not worried about it the way we are now, or the context has changed around it. So I would like to see Bitcoin use more energy. It would be good for everybody, be good for mankind.
Is what you're referencing the Kardashev scale? Is that it?
Potentially.
Anybody who just listened should Google that if you're not familiar with that. It's like the, you know, bringing us into a different civilatory state. But yeah, Bitcoin mining incentivizes more energy generation build out as well, right? So there's that. Brad, where can folks find you if they wanted to follow you or get in touch or learn more about your products and projects?
Sure. You guys can find me anywhere on Twitter. Pick your favorite platform. Look for Brad James. Most of the Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You can search Mining with Brad. Miningwithbrad.com is our homepage, and you can get to all the programs from there. Build a Mine, Miner Mastery, the Micro Minery Club, etc. Hosting anything there. And then if you want to tune in, you know, every day from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern, we help support the Bitcoin Daily Show, which happens on Twitter. Variety of topics. My big goal, guys, is to really help educate people and bring people into the space, because I do think that whether you're a miner or just a Bitcoiner, it's the next step towards freedom and having your ability to do what you want to do to achieve your dreams in your life. That would be the best thing. So check all those out.
Absolutely. Guys, if you learned anything new, which I'm sure you did, you know what to do. Leave a like, leave a follow. Give Brad a message. There's a lot of mistakes that you can make a lot more cheaply by contacting him and going with him if you're looking to even start mining. Maybe you're already mining, right? Maybe you already have an operation. You're looking to level it up. Get in touch with Brad. I'm sure he'll have a lot more insights to share than what he's already shared. I know I have a ton more questions for him. And I have a feeling he's going to be back maybe on treasury management next time. Who knows? Yeah, until next time, guys. See you next Sunday. Cheers. Bye.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
My pleasure.